those who are mentored out-earn, outperform those who are not. They get promoted more often, they have less burnout, and they're more satisfied, not just their job, but also in their career. We also know that there's research to show that while it also helps the person being mentored, the mentee, it also helps the organization, because we know that recruiting and retaining top talent is such a challenge. And those who are mentored remain more loyal to the organization. Again, this is research that's going on for a quarter of a century.
Welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast, hosted by Andy LaPata, the show where Andy and his guests explore the many ways in which relationships impact business decisions, make leaders' jobs easier, and help you to progress your career.
Hello, welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast. I'm not Andy LaPata. I'm Alan Stevens. Thank you very much for joining me. My guests this week are Andy LaPata and Dr. Ruth Gautier, and the co-authors of the Financial Times Guide to Mentoring. Welcome both.
It's such a pleasure to be on this podcast. I've heard so much about it.
It's very good.
It's one of the best ones to be a guest on, Andy.
Absolutely.
What a treat to be a guest on your own podcast. But we've got a lot to talk about today, so let's crack on. As I said, you are the co-authors of the newly released Financial Times Guide to Mentoring. Very, very current. But obviously what a lot of people are going to be thinking is, what I'm thinking, what the first question is going to be, how do you define mentoring? Andy.
Ruth, do you want to kick us off?
Kick us off with your better accent.
Okay. How do we define mentoring? For me, mentoring is an exchange of experience, of skills, of expertise, where someone who has insights that another needs helps them along that pathway, along that journey.
See, that's why I partnered with Andy, because he gives these short, pithy responses that are just mic drops. And there he did it with that definition of mentoring. Perfect, Andy.
Thank you. Maybe that's why my mic's broken. I keep dropping it.
That's what it's all about. Thank you very much for joining me today. No. Lots to talk. So, okay, that's a definition of mentoring, which many people will be interested in, hopefully aware of. But more important than that is that's what mentoring is. But who is mentoring for? Mentoring, is it for everybody? Is it for a small group of people? Is it for certain types of people?
I think it's for everybody. I think everyone should mentor one and everyone should be mentored, because there's no one here who has all the answers and we all have blinders on. And there are other people around us who can offer ideas, and it could be someone senior to us, someone at our level, or someone junior to us. So everyone should be open to that. And we know it works. We know those who are mentored out-earn and outperform those who are not. So if you want to level up your game, find yourself a mentor and be a mentor.
One of the challenges, and one of the reasons we wrote the book, is there's a lot of confusion about what mentoring is and who it's for, and particularly who it's for. So people tend to think that mentoring is only for certain people at a certain stage of their career development. And Ruth's answer is so important for that reason, that there is no time at which it is absolutely right that you have a mentor. It is when you have a need, when you need support and you need guidance, reach out and talk to people wherever you are on that journey.
So, okay, so we know what it is. We know who it's for. But why is it important? I mean, can you manage without mentoring? Is it essentially, you both hinted at that it's a really important aspect of people's career development and how people get on. Obviously, you think mentoring is important. You've written the book between you. Why do you think it's so important?
I think, look, you can get through life and career without a mentor, but it's going to be harder. The hill is going to be steeper. More doors are going to be closed to you because you don't know what you don't know. So if you want to get those promotions, and if you want to be able to access certain people, and if you want to be able to work on more impactful projects, you need to have a mentor, because you can learn from not just their successes, you can also learn from their mistakes and their hiccups and all the knowledge. What they forgot, you'll never know. So the longer you spend with that mentor, the more you can tap into their experiences and their knowledge.
Even if you feel that you can get through life without a mentor, the bottom line is that you are going to really struggle if you don't get advice from anyone. if you have no one sharing their experiences. And I'm sure we are going to talk at some point about the difference between formal and informal mentors. You may think you're getting through life without a mentor. That doesn't necessarily mean that you are. You could still be surrounded by people to whom you turn for guidance, for advice, for insights along the way, or who just offer it to you. So I think that even where people think they can get on without a mentor, they're not really.
Okay, I'm going to challenge that a little bit, as you might expect me to, because there's a lot of information around these days. Information is free. You can find out anything on YouTube or TikTok or Insta or whatever you want to know. You could get advice from literally anywhere. So why is it so important to have an individual or group of individuals to talk to? Why can't you just go and look it up on TikTok or YouTube?
You can, but you need someone who's going to help you curate that information. And how do you differentiate between the good information, the bad information, the misinformation? And really, the mentor is going to save you a lot of time, a lot of time. And if you tell me, I'm still waiting for someone to tell me what the downside is to having one.
Okay, good
answer. I haven't heard it.
I would also argue that context is key. Maybe artificial intelligence will change things over time. I would still argue not to the full degree. But at this stage, when you ask Google a question, it doesn't know you. When you ask Google a question, it doesn't know the specifics of where you work, the politics of your workplace, the environment, the challenges that you face. You're going to get a generic response. And context is so important. Those little nuances can make all the differences between success and failure. The answer that someone typed into a website that's been picked up by Google may have been perfect for them, but won't necessarily be for you. Now, that's exactly the same in a mentoring conversation, but at least there you can have the conversation about it and explore it. You can't do that as easily with a web search.
Okay, fair enough. But you mentioned challenges there, Andy. You talked about challenges and mentoring. You wouldn't have written the book if mentoring was a straightforward, simple process that we could pick up in 2 minutes. There must be some challenges. There must be some things that you need to think about. So perhaps you could maybe both of you outline a few of the challenges that are involved in creating this successful mentoring relationship.
Yeah, well, I would start with focus. I think that this goes with a lot of the work that I do. We know inherently that there is value in mentoring, just as we know there's value in professional relationships or referral strategies. But we don't necessarily put the attention, the spotlight onto it that it deserves. We don't have a strategic approach to it. So what will happen is that people pay lip service to mentoring but don't find themselves a mentor. Or they'll ask someone to mentoring without thinking what they want to achieve. Or they'll agree a mentoring relationship without discussing expectations and accountability. So there are multiple challenges, but a lot of them simply come down to strategic thinking, thoughtful thinking, and focus.
Okay. Ruth?
Once again, I agree with Andy's pithy answers, which are perfection. I really think that mentor is going to get you on the right track, but you have to come in, you know, meet them at the 50-yard line, as we say. Tell them exactly what it is that you need help with. Saying I need help with my career is too generic. I mean, right. Where do I start with that as a mentor? But if you are more focused, as Andy said, and more specific, saying I need help with this specific axis, I'm working toward a promotion. Well, now there's something we can get behind. Now there's that context. Now there is, we can come up with a game plan because there's a very specific goal that we can name and claim. And once we are able to do that, we can come up with a plan.
Excellent. So you've given a great exposition, in fact, of why mentoring is important and why it's useful and why it's for everybody. But there are still going to be some people listening, I'm sure, who are thinking, and what's the evidence? What's the proof? How do we know that mentoring works? And I'm sure you've delved into this. You must have looked into examples of successful mentoring. What evidence have you come up with? What evidence can you quote that mentoring really works?
I've partnered with an academic because she picks out all the statistics. We are so evidenced in this book, you wouldn't believe it. So I was going to say I tell the stories and Ruth shares the data, but Ruth tells great stories as well. So I'm coming out second here. Ruth, share some stats.
I will. Okay. So let's start with this. We know that there's a lot of research, and this research has been going on for a quarter of a century. And it's been done in multiple different industries. And it repeatedly says that those who are mentored out-earn, outperform those who are not. They get promoted more often. They have less burnout and they're more satisfied, not just their job, but also in their career. We also know that there's research to show that while it also helps the person being mentored, the mentee, it also helps the organization because we know that recruiting and retaining top talent is such a challenge. And those who are mentored remain more loyal to the organization. Again, this is research that's going on for a quarter of a century. Now, with all of this, hopefully we've convinced people that mentoring is a good thing. And most people actually agree. Two-thirds of people agree. They have heard these stats. They have heard Andy and I talking and yelling from the rooftops. They're going to read our book. 76% of people understand the benefits of having a mentor. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, only 37% of people have one.
Oh.
And that's an issue that we took a deep dive into. Why is that? What's the problem? There's a lot of the matching programs that do not have a lot of great stats that they're actually very beneficial. And we know that 61% of people meet their mentors organically. And that's one of the reasons that I was so excited to partner with Andy on this book, because whenever it comes to developing professional relationships and finding people organically and knowing how to kick off those conversations and maintain those relationships, Andy's the global expert. So that's why the academic with this professional expert on these relationships was such a good match.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sure you're going to take that praise, Andy, because it's well deserved. So
in the bank.
Absolutely fantastic. So well done. I'm impressed and informed. So thank you. Thank you for that. So now, as you said, talk about diving deeper. Let's go a little bit deeper into mentoring, because for a lot of people, mentoring is simply an experienced person talking to a less experienced person. And kind of that's their model of mentoring. But I know, because obviously I've read your book, your wonderful book, that it's a lot more nuanced and complicated than that. There are different types of mentoring. So perhaps you could outline some of the different types of mentoring alongside that kind of traditional one, if I can call it that, that work in terms of a mentoring relationship.
Yeah, we call that model the traditional hierarchical because it's how we see mentoring. It is very much the young junior person sitting at the feet of the normally male gray-haired font of all wisdom. And there is still a place for that. As I say, you are one of my mentors because you've been around a little bit longer. Not much, but a little bit. But it's not the only model. And I should say, by the way, that the stereotype is of the man, but that doesn't mean that the person who has all the wisdom is necessarily male. So we do have to break those images we have in our minds, those stereotypes, so that we can be more open to different types of mentoring relationships. The next one that people will be very familiar with is reverse mentoring. And Ruth touched on this in an earlier answer, where the wisdom, the experience, the expertise is actually someone more junior than you, possibly younger than you. And reverse mentoring has been around for years, but I think it is more pertinent now than it has ever been. In a world where we have more generations under the same roof, in a world where the digital world has accelerated in the last 10 or 20 years at a faster pace than ever before. And in the lifetime of many people who are still in the workplace, you know, even at my relatively young age, remember working without a computer and with paper files. I know it's hard to believe. In a world where sustainability and environmental challenges are really, to a large degree, the world of younger people, senior leaders need to be mentored by people who are junior to them, who are in touch with all of these different elements. So reverse mentoring is key. And then the third one I would pick out as an overview is peer mentoring, where you actually may have something to offer each other. You provide mutual support. Alan, you and I both have been in many mastermind groups over the years. We were in the same one for a while as well, where groups of peers get together and say, this is my challenge, help me find a solution. So it's about sharing different perspectives and getting different insights. So that's just three models, only one of which is the one that we typically see as mentoring.
I'd ask Ruth to come in. Obviously, Ruth, you know about the models, you know all of these different types of mentoring. We're going to come on to formal versus informal in a moment. So let's just park that for a second or two. But in terms of those different types of relationships, you've got the hierarchical, you've got the reverse mentoring, you've got the peer-to-peer. Is just one right for each individual? Could you have several going on at the same time? And how would that work?
You can. And one of the things that we do, we actually talk about six different models of mentoring. You see, this book, I used to be a dean for mentoring at an Ivy League academic medical center. And I had searched high and low for good books on mentoring and didn't find exactly what I needed. So, which is why Andy and I wrote it, because this really offers everything. And we talk about the six different models of mentoring. And one of the things we talk about, in addition to everything that Andy discussed, was having mentoring teams. People who, it's a robust 360, people at different levels from different industries who can offer insights to you. So again, you'll have people senior to you, at your level, junior to you, within your industry, outside of your industry. And you're able to cherry pick who you talk to based on what you need at that time. Mm-hmm. So we talk about these different opportunities that you have, but we also tell you how to start and engage those conversations and keep them going. So it's filled with scripts and worksheets and templates that the reader can use.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I referred there to formal versus informal. I think you both mentioned it a while back. Let's look in more depth at that. You've got formal mentoring versus informal. What does that mean when you talk about formal versus informal? What exactly do you mean?
We were talking about the stereotypes in my last answer. One of the stereotypes, particularly when you talk about the traditional hierarchical model, is that of a mentoring relationship where you are my mentor. We have regular meetings. You will hopefully hold me accountable to what I promise in those meetings. We'll follow an agenda. That's formal mentoring, and it has a very strong place in the mentoring universe. But within that mentoring team that Ruth was talking about, you can have several informal mentors as well. Those people where you're not necessarily on a regular rotation of meetings and following a particular pathway, but they are people you will reach out to when you have a particular challenge. So to give an example, when I first had to deliver a talk overseas in a country where English wasn't the first language, I reached out to two or three of my speaking colleagues. You were probably one of them. I know Graham Codrington, a South African speaker who speaks internationally a lot, was another. And I said, if I'm speaking to an audience for whom English is not their first language, what do I need to know? Yeah. And I got advice that was invaluable. When I then moved on and I had a talk at a similar environment, but where I had a translator working with me, an interpreter, I again asked the question around that environment and I got answers that helped me. So when a challenge came up, I knew who I would turn to. Those are the people I would call my informal mentors. They haven't made an arrangement with me. They probably wouldn't call themselves my mentor, but I see them as part of that mentoring team. If I have a challenge in a particular area, I know who to pick the phone up to.
Excellent. We should just emphasize they are interpreters there, because I know we upset people. Yes. We call them translators and we get all sorts of phone calls.
You know, Alan, we talk about informal mentoring and you asked me earlier about research, and the research shows that the informal mentoring is more effective than formal mentoring. But there is definitely a place for formal mentoring as well. And I just want to read two sentences from the book that'll help crystallize that. It says, more often than not, voluntary mentoring programs tend to attract those who need mentorship least, as they are independently seeking it out. In addition, research has shown many people won't seek mentoring or know where to start without the right support from the employer. This challenge disproportionately impacts women and underrepresented minority groups. Having a formal mentoring program in place gives people somewhere to find the support they need. So there is definitely a place for the formal mentoring programs as well. And it helps really to help those who are not going to seek it out on their own to make sure that they are not left in the dust.
And would it be fair to say that any mentoring relationship could include both formality and informality? I'm guessing that could certainly happen. It doesn't have to be one or the other, does it?
Absolutely.
My formal mentor at the moment, I saw a few weeks ago for the first time in over a year, because where I was on the journey and the support I wanted from him, the two weren't aligned for quite a while. So we have a relationship where we don't need to meet on that regular basis. But when I do need mentoring, we will sit down and talk. And this is where the formality comes in, because when we first agreed a mentoring relationship, so we formally agreed that he would be my mentor. When we first met up, we did it over lunch. And we both get on very well with each other. We have a lot in common. We spent too much time chatting,
right?
Small talk, talking about the football, talk about the gigs we'd been to, the cricket, whatever it might be. I said deliberately, I want the next meeting to be at your office. We can have lunch before or after, absolutely fine. But I want the next meeting to be at your office. So now we will meet in a formal environment, because that gives us the focus that I talked about earlier.
It's a tricky balance, isn't it? I mean, I know, you won't mind me revealing this, but you do, we talk to each other on the phone.
Yeah.
From time to time, when issues come up, I'll call you or you'll call me. So we kind of mentor each other, I suppose. Co-mentoring, perhaps, that is. Or peer-to-peer, isn't it? And I think both of us will cut to the chase fairly quickly. There's obviously a little bit of socializing to begin with. You know, how's things been going? What have you been up to? And so on. But then here's the question. And I think that's important, isn't it?
It is important. You do have to recognize personality type in that. I think that while you and I share a lot in common and we've had a lot of social time together as well, and we can very easily get together and not talk about work at all, you also have quite a transactional side to your nature. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but when there is a key point, you're very clear and focused on that point. So if the conversation with you has that outcome related element, then it's very natural to get quickly to that in that conversation. There will be other people where we might spend a lot longer before we get to that point. And I've had conversations. I've had hour-long meetings where we spent 50 minutes, and these aren't mentoring meetings, I hasten to say, but 50 minutes on relationship building, if you want to call it that. But in that 10 remaining minutes of the hour, we can get so much done. So I think you have to look at personality type. Well.
Yeah, so the conversation with us will often go, yes, I enjoyed the holiday very much. What can I do for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I don't talk about the football, yes.
Oh, no, not at the moment. So in that same chapter where you talk about formal versus informal mentoring, you also talk about sector-wide mentoring and cross-sector mentoring. Perhaps, Andy, you could give us some guidance on what you mean by that.
Yes, we talk to people who actually run sector-wide programs. So a sector-wide program will be a program within a particular industry or sector. So we have people who run mentoring programs within the events space, for example. So they will, like many professional associations will do this as well, but there are these specific organizations. So they will say, if you work in the event space, and you want a mentor, or you want to mentor other people on that journey, then we will put you together. We will match you. And that can be very effective. Cross-sector, we're talking about where you can bring in different perspectives, different ideas, break out of your bubble. So if you work in financial services, you don't necessarily just want all of your mentoring team to also come from financial services, because they will think the same way as you do. There will be set accepted solutions to challenges. So you stifle innovation and ideas. If you're in financial services and you can have someone mentor you from a retail background or event sector, hospitality, they're going to bring their own accepted wisdom, but it's going to be different to yours. So that's going to spark new ideas, new approaches, and challenge you more. So that's what we mean by cross-sector.
Okay. So if I could use a sporting analogy, if I may. It would be like bringing in a coach, mentor, whatever you want to call them, from a different sport, because they had a mindset that was helpful to another sport, perhaps.
And that happened with an interviewee from one of my earlier books, Sir Clive Woodward, who was, you know, World Cup winning England rugby coach, became director of football at Southampton Football Club.
Oh, we're going to talk about sports. The perfect example is actually the guy who wrote the foreword to our book,
indeed,
Steve Kerr,
yeah.
Nine-time NBA champion, coach of the Golden State Warriors. He's now coaching Team USA for basketball for the Olympics. And in his foreword, he wrote about when he made the transition from player to coach, he reached out to his mentor, who was a football coach. And he said to him, how are you going to coach your team? And he said, oh, I have these defensive plays. I have the offensive plays. I have these warm-ups. And he said, how are you going to coach your team?
Right.
In what he meant was, what are the values of the team? And how are you going to inculcate those values into the tapestry of the team so it becomes part of who you are? So I think that would be a perfect example. And we are so honored that Steve Kerr wrote the foreword to the book.
Fantastic. That's great.
Enhance your mentoring skills with the Financial Times Guide to Mentoring by Andy Lapata and Dr. Ruth Gotian. Secure your copy early by pre-ordering today on Amazon or your preferred bookseller.
The next chapter I want to talk about in the book is mentoring is not coaching. There's a lot of people think, oh, mentors, coaches, they're all the same. They're all interchangeable, but they are not. It's not the same thing at all. So let's just have a few minutes just defining the difference between mentoring and coaching.
I think mentoring is more long-term and it's more throughout your career. There's no real end date to it, where coaching is more time-bound and it's more specific to help you with something very, very specific. Now, we do have, you know, we're from both sides of the pond here. So certain things we have learned are a little bit different in North America versus in Europe. In the United States, for example, mentors generally do not get paid.
Right.
Coaches get paid. Mentors do not. But as I have learned from partnering with Andy, is that in the UK, mentors do get paid.
Or can get paid. Because we do, within an organization, you wouldn't expect it. And those cross-sector, within sector mentoring ones, you wouldn't expect it. But we have professional mentors as well. And, you know, I'm a member of the Association of Business Mentors. And many of those, it's how they earn their money now, very much like coaches. The other difference that I always focus in on is that mentors, as I explained right at the top of the podcast, mentors have the expertise, they have the experience, they have the miles under their belt in the particular area you want to explore and talk about. Coaches don't necessarily. A coach will come in and they have a skill set. They don't have the knowledge, they have the skill set. They have the ability to help you find the answers for yourself. So coaches are great listeners. Coaches are great questioners. Mentors share their experience. Having said that, it's not binary. And a great mentor will coach. You know, so if I'm mentoring someone and they have I'll mentor predominantly around professional relationships. If someone comes up with a challenge, I will often see what I feel is the right route very quickly. But to be effective in my role, I need to guide my mentee to that answer for themselves using coaching technique rather than just simply telling them. But if you're taking a very clear-cut difference, a mentor will have the answer somewhere within their background, the coach not necessarily.
There's a great quote, I think, I can't remember who it's from, at the start of that chapter about mentoring and coaching. And it's something like, I'm trying to remember it now, it's something like coaches ask great questions and mentors have great answers.
That's right, John Crosby.
Ah, there we are. Thank you very much, Ruth. So there we are. That's useful academic verification there.
No, I had the book open right in front of me.
Oh, yeah, apart from that. You're the one with the book in front of you. Andy and I are trying to remember it.
Spoken like a true academic.
I'm still waiting to receive my copy at the time of recording, whereas Ruth in New York, the book sent from London, got hers first.
And you both wrote it, and I'm working from memory. But I've got the notes, so that's fine. I know this is part two of the book because I've wrote it down. And this is about why on earth should you mentor others? How do you feel confident enough to mentor others? And this is something in the book where you refer to imposter syndrome. Now, am I good enough to be a mentor? How do you get over that?
And actually, I interviewed a mutual friend of ours and a former podcast guest, Caroline Flanagan, in terms of how you overcome imposter syndrome. One of the key things that I would turn to with that is having the conversation and talking to people and listening to what they say to you about why they want you to mentor them. And, you know, when you suffer from imposter syndrome, the tendency is to brush away praise and look for the cracks, look for the flaws, look for the criticism. Ask people why they want you to mentor them and listen to the praise and accept it. And I think for me, that's the first thing anyone can do in terms of convincing themselves that, yes, I am worth, you know, the time, I am worth giving the advice, and I can deliver value to other people.
Absolutely.
Ruth, would you say is there something in it for you in being a mentor?
So one of the people we featured in the book is Dr. Bob Lefkowitz. He won the Nobel Prize in 2012 in chemistry. Now, if you know the Nobel Prizes in the sciences, they're usually given to up to three people.
Yeah.
One of the co-recipients that year of the Nobel Prize was Dr. Lefkowitz's mentee.
Oh.
And I asked him, I said, is that weird that you're sharing the Nobel Prize, the biggest award there is in the sciences, you're sharing it with your mentee? And he said, now, mind you, he's mentored about 350 people at this point. He said, there is no greater achievement than seeing your mentee succeed. That is how he measures how good he is as a mentor, right? So I think that is so, so critical that you can help your mentees succeed and not be dampened by their success, but actually be excited for it. The one thing I wanted to also point out in the book is that while we talk about all these things and we share stories to bring it color, remember, we wanted this book to offer actionable tips that people can implement immediately. So we talk about imposter syndrome, we have the stories, we have the data to back it up, but we also have infographics that say, so for example, you turn to page 54, there's four things you can do to overcome imposter syndrome and be a successful mentor, right? So I think that'll be extremely helpful to the reader as well.
Can I just pick up on something that Ruth said and this Bob Lefkowitz's story and how he took pleasure in the success of his mentee? And that shines a light on one of the most important traits in mentoring. And I think it's another way to combat imposter syndrome is you make it about your mentee and not about you. And when you're focused on yourself, that's when imposter syndrome can kick in.
That's right.
Okay. That's about overcoming imposter syndrome. And that's great advice, Ruth, about looking at the infographics and the stuff. There's some very, very good information in there about the mentoring relationship, which is what I want to talk about in a bit more detail. Now, and the responsibilities of a mentor. I know there's got a fabulous mnemonic in there, which we might not have time to go through in detail, the ice cream mnemonic, I think it is, which is, again, very, very helpful to understand what responsibilities are. But generally speaking, how would you outline the responsibilities of a mentor?
So ice cream is something that I developed when I was training mentors. I'm like, these are the things that you need to do in order to really, really be effective. You want to introduce your mentee to opportunities. You want to connect them with other people. You want to engage with them in conversation, not just give them a to-do list. So that's the ice. We talked about the creating opportunities, reply to them when they seek your guidance or have questions that they're emailing you or texting you about. You want to encourage them. Part of it is just being their cheerleader. It's not just the career advice, but it's also the psychosocial support. And when they do succeed, you want to amplify it, right? That's the A. And finally, the M is to motivate them. Motivate them to break out of their shell, to do things that are uncomfortable, and to try something new.
Brilliant. It's a great mnemonic. And there's a piece of an ice cream to go with it in the book, which is lovely. And Andy, anything to add to that in terms of what the responsibilities of a good mentor should be?
I think I would go back to what I said just previously, which is to focus on your mentee and not on yourself. Leave your ego at the door. It's not about impressing your mentee. Your mentee will learn more from you if you share your doubts, your challenges and your mistakes than they will if you share your successes. Ruth said earlier that you can learn from other people's failures. And if you are an effective mentor, that means that you don't worry about sharing those failures. So for me, the number one thing is where your head is at. And your head should be, how can I make the biggest impact on the career or the journey of my mentee, irrespective of the perceived cost to me and my pride?
Andy, you know, the reason that's so important is because when we connect with somebody, it's the achievement might be the first thing, but that's not how we connect. That's the reason they're on our radar. If you think about the people who you most respect as leaders and the people who you respect their journey, it's not so much what they achieved, it's what they overcame. Because we can usually relate to people's difficulties. We all have difficulties in our lives. So if you were fired from a job, if you didn't get a project that you were hoping to get, whatever it is, that we can each relate to. So sharing those bumps and bruises is so critical because that is how you're going to get those connections.
You see that come into play a lot in politics, don't you? In both of our countries. I mean, the leader of the opposition here, Keir Starmer, has just, well, was going to be an autobiography became a biography, but it's his getting his origin story out, because he's Sir Keir Starmer. He doesn't want to be seen as part of the establishment. Our Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, keeps stressing that despite being the wealthiest Prime Minister we've ever had, he came from relatively humble backgrounds. And Joe Biden in the US, you know, keeps emphasizing his roots as well. Less said about the other candidate, maybe the better. It's just interesting to see how what you've said plays out on that grand scale of global politics.
So what you've done there, what you've started to do there, is to touch on not just the responsibilities of a mentor, but also the ingredients of an effective mentoring relationship, which is what we're coming on to now. You've talked a bit about vulnerability. You both referred to being vulnerable, but you also talk about aspects like agility and rapport, respect and trust. So how do all those play into a successful and effective mentoring relationship?
Well, in terms of, let's start with agility. You can't go in with a set mindset. You can't go in and say, this is the direction we're going to take. As a mentor, the best example of that is, this worked for me, therefore it will work for you. And I touched on that earlier. You need to be agile and be able to respond to changes of circumstances, changes of direction for your mentee, different context for your mentee, different politics in the organization today compared to when you navigated them, whatever it might be. Obviously, we've seen the importance of agility on a grander scale in the last few years, COVID being the most obvious example. And you know, if you were in a mentoring relationship around the time of COVID, the mentee would have been absolutely reliant on their mentor to help them navigate that huge change. But the mentor has to be agile to do that. So if I take agility as the first one, pass the second one on to Ruth.
Which was rapport.
So I think being able to connect and having that rapport is so critical. But I think it also, you have to be agile, because we all have these peaks and plateaus in our day and in our weeks and in our months. And knowing how to shift that a little bit, I think, is so critical. We share the story of two incredible women who we call frentors, who have this rapport that started when they met as grad students. And it continued to this day. One is now the president of a university. The other is a dean of Wharton, one of the biggest business schools probably in the world. And it's that rapport. It's that connection. It is that safe space that they had for each other that allowed them to be each other's mentors. And they've even written some books together.
Fantastic. So another thing in here, we've talked about respect and trust, which we can perhaps wrap up into the next response. And that you talk about the age, so there might be an age difference between mentor and mentee, the maybe neurodiversity issues that come into play. How do those affect the relationship, the fact that people might be effectively quite different in terms of being a mentor and a mentee?
I think it's a positive thing if you embrace it and if you're conscious of it and you respond accordingly. You know, I talked earlier about the importance of cross-sector mentoring and getting out of your bubble. That goes to not just being mentored by people like you as well. So going back to what Ruth was talking about earlier in terms of mentoring teams, we feel comfortable being mentored by people like us. That's fine. Have them on your team. But also look for that difference on your team as well. The neurodivergence is something I'd just like to touch upon, because I think it's a really important point. It's becoming more and more prevalent as we understand more about it. I found myself with a mentee who I didn't know was neurodivergent. She hadn't realized at the time herself. She actually turned out to be autistic and high ADHD. And she had a breakdown in the middle of a mentoring session. And I didn't know how to respond because I wasn't aware what was happening. And so now that experience, plus we talked to Dr. Sam Hugh of ADHD Girls in the book about how to work with people with different types of neurodiversity as a mentor, as an organization as well. I think we can be better teed up now than we ever have been to respond to that. But it's about being aware. It's about being cognizant of what's going on.
And I will share, we have, again, this is that, you know, 10 things you can do when working with a neurodivergent mentee. But to be transparent, I think if you do this also with people who are not neurodivergent, it'll make you that much better of a mentor, because you will be more aware of the subtleties of what is being said and what is not being said. So I think while these tools were built for neurodivergent mentees, I think they are absolutely applicable to non-neurodivergent mentees as well, and it will make you a stronger mentor.
That's great. Thank you. So the last point in this particular section about an effective relationship, we talk about the face-to-face relationship, about mentoring, about, you know, direct face-to-face, but now we're talking about, as we talk about asynchronous mentoring, where it's a different style of communication. You're not both there at the same time. How on earth does that work?
You're talking to two people who haven't met each other in person until after they submitted the book manuscript.
Just thought I'd throw that in.
Look, there's some people who I think who are insist on the in-person mentoring, but I think there's so many people who actually find it easier to have it async. You do lose a little bit on reading the body language and getting the temperature of the room sometimes, but there's so many ways that you can actually leverage the virtual mentoring, which may be async as well. And I think that is so helpful, especially if you want to start mentoring people across time zones. And this is, again, one of the places that we give you 10 steps to asynchronous ways to communicate with your mentee, right? So you can do the DMs and you can do the texting and you could do the email and you can use different platforms and you can have shared document collaboration such as the Google Drive. The opportunities are limitless if you're open to them.
Is that your experience, Andy?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think back to what I was saying earlier about the informal mentoring where you have a particular problem or a particular question, shall I say, you don't always need the answer to that question immediately. And sometimes it's better to have it in terms of here's some useful resources or here's some bullet points that will help you with that particular challenge. So do you actually have to have a face-to-face or even virtual in the same time conversation to get that outcome? So we just need to be open. And again, it comes back to deconstructing stereotypes of mentoring. And we just need to be open to what we're trying to achieve rather than what something looks like if we apply that label to it. And if you take away the label, then yeah, of course asynchronous works.
Yeah.
If we use this example for a minute, let's say I'm the mentor and Andy is the mentee, and we meet every other Tuesday at 10 o'clock. But now it's Thursday, 48 hours since Andy and I met in person, and he has a question. He has a challenge he's being faced with, and he needs someone to talk it through. Or there's an opportunity that just came. He needs the opportunity to, you know, talk it through with someone. Does he now need to wait 12 days to discuss it because our next scheduled meeting is in 2 weeks, you know, Tuesday at 10? Or can he shoot me a quick email or voicemail or whatever it is, and we solve it that way? Right. And I think the answer is solve it in real time.
Solve it.
And as much as I, to a large degree, loathe them, I have to admit that the rise of voice notes, predominantly on WhatsApp, but they're also available on LinkedIn and elsewhere, that does change the game a lot as well.
For sure.
Yeah. Okay. How do you deliver the best value, though, when you're mentoring? How do you know you're delivering best value? So I'm going to wrap up a couple of questions here. It's how do you measure it? How do you know it's working? And how do you deliver best value? I'm going to throw a few phrases at you that you put in your book. You talk about listening for, not to. You talk about parking your ego, and you talk about the helicopter view. So wrapping all of that together in delivering best value and then measuring it, how do you do that?
Well, let's start with the overarching question. How do you measure results? Well, the first thing you need to do is work out what's tangible and what's intangible. So if it is a tangible goal you're working towards, it's a promotion, it's the winning of new businesses or winning a pitch or creating new opportunities, you've got a clear measurement of success. So I mentored 6 directors of a large accounting firm over a number of months. 4 of them made partner. That wasn't our overall goal, but it was certainly within their objectives that I would help them towards. And all 4 of them said that my work helped them towards that goal. That's a tangible proof, tangible evidence of success. But you've also got your intangibles. And the intangibles might be, I want to be more confident delivering a presentation. So that's a lot harder to measure. You can't measure confidence. You can go on a gut feel. But it might mean, well, if you were more confident delivering presentations, what would that look like? And what it might look like is you might be stepping forward more often to take the opportunity. So can you measure how many presentations you've delivered compared to how many you did before the mentoring, as an example? So you could measure activity that would naturally come as a result of the goal you're trying to achieve. So I think you look at the tangibles, you look at the intangibles, and you say, well, okay, based on that, how can we measure impact? I'll also take the listening for, because that's my phrase, and it's one that I've shared for many, many years. It's probably in more than one of my books. And that is that I always believe that we get the language wrong when we say we listen to people, because listening to doesn't suggest that you're doing anything with it. It doesn't suggest activity. It just is passive rather than active. Listening for is different. It also means you're taking yourself out of the equation. If you're listening to someone, you might be processing that information with your own end in mind. If you're listening for them, it's all there in the phrase. It's about what they're trying to achieve. So that's where I'm coming from when I say listening for people.
Okay.
We do reference, you know, whenever you talk about success, there's a lot of work with athletes. And one of the people who we interviewed was two-time NBA champion Zaza Pachulia, who I believe was a previous guest on your show.
Yes, yes, as was Bob Lefkowitz.
As was Bob Lefkowitz. And what Zaza talked about, now he was in the NBA for 14, 15 years, which is three times the average length. And he said, in order to succeed, it's the small details that differentiate between being good and outstanding. And the issue is you don't notice those small details in the moment. But when you layer the small details one on top of the other, then over time you do see it. Yeah. Now, we had a situation here last May where an NBA player, he was at a press conference and he was asked about the latest game, the latest season that didn't go as he would have wanted. And his response went viral because it was so insightful. He asked the reporter back, he said, "Did you get a promotion this year? Do you get a promotion every year?" And the reporter said, "No, I don't get a promotion every year." So the basketball player said, "So every year your work is a failure?" "No, every year you work towards a goal. It's not a failure. It's steps to success."
I can imagine some sporting interviews going rather badly if that was dealt with like that all the time. But never, that's just another story there.
The brilliant response there.
Yeah, it is a great response. So We've talked a lot about mentoring and mentoring relationships and successful mentoring. So I just want to finish off by talking about being mentored, because you said early on, both of you said early on, that it's important that you can be mentored as well as to be a mentor. So if you're going to be mentored by somebody, is it ever too late to find yourself a mentor?
I gave the short, pithy answer, Andy.
You gave a short, pithy answer and brilliantly done. And you also gave that answer at the beginning when you said anyone could have a mentor wherever you are on the journey. So, of course not. When coaches talk about their world and their work, they will talk about the top performers in any sport and they will say they have a coach. And it's no difference with mentoring. Top performers can always do things differently, do things better, eke out that extra few percent. But when you are that performer, you can't necessarily see where that change is needed. You need external eyes to help you understand where you can perform even better.
Okay, so my penultimate question before I ask you for a bit of a summary right at the end is, if you're going to find yourself a mentor, if you're going to be mentored, how do you do that? How do you get right? And I know this is something that you've talked about a lot, Andy. How do you ask for help?
Well, the first thing I'll say is that Ruth mentioned that there were a couple of things that we recognized some differences with. And the first one was whether mentors get paid or not. The second was whether you could ask someone to mentor you or not. I have asked people to mentor me and I've had people say yes and I've had people say no. I have also been asked by others to mentor them and I have said yes and I have said no. I think it's fine. However, I think that in an ideal world, you would have a relationship with them first. There would be trust in place. And most importantly, I mentioned in both illustrations, I said no or the other person said no to me. You have to be okay with a no. So when I talk about what stops us asking for help, I talk about assuming that people can't or won't help us and avoiding it because we take the no as a rejection. We need to understand that a no isn't a rejection. A no can have countless reasons. And if you're asking people when the relationship is strong, then there's no reason why it should be because of you. But having recognized that and recognized that difference in the, you know, the North American viewpoint certainly seems to be you should never ask. And I understand exactly where they're coming from. Ruth feels that. Dori Clark, who we feature in the book, feels that very strongly as well. We quote Dori on that, I think. You don't always have to ask people to mentor you. You can ask them for advice and guidance. And you almost evolve the mentoring relationship. But I think the core of it, and I wouldn't say never approach someone new, because I mentor someone who approached me totally stone dead cold. But there were reasons I said yes. But the key to it is evolve, evolution. Let the relationship develop and grow trust and a bond between you, the rapport we talked about earlier, so that it is natural to ask for their opinion. So it's natural to ask for their guidance and their ideas. And that can evolve into a more formal relationship if you need it.
Right. Ruth, any thoughts on that?
So the American view, which I align with, is that you don't ask, right? Because, and I wouldn't worry about asking because you're asking someone to take on yet another role, yet another label. Everyone's busy. We all have enough labels. So instead, as Andy suggested, we recommend that you ask someone for their guidance. And we actually give scripts in the book of how you can do that.
Very good.
Right? We talked about contacts and how to ask someone. I need your help with this. I'm going up for a promotion and could use your perspective on X. I want to be able to do this project and would really want to talk through with you how to best approach it. The title of mentor is earned, and it's earned when the mentee gives it to you. You don't walk around calling yourself a mentor because that takes work. That takes commitment. But when you have helped somebody to the point that the mentee starts calling you your mentor, there's no greater feeling in the world. So don't worry about the titles. We all have enough hyphens in our name and in our titles. Do the good work and you'll see that when you do, the mentee will start calling you on.
Fantastic answer. Thank you. And thank you both, sir.
Very, very pithy, Ruth.
Sorry?
Very pithy.
I'm getting there.
got pithier through the interview. That's been fantastic. So I'm just going to ask you in conclusion, each of you in turn, to kind of sum up the value of this. Is a fantastic book. So just sum up, if you can, in a sentence or two, the value of this book and why you think it'll be helpful to people. For Andy first.
I started out by saying that mentoring is not really considered enough. We understand in the back of our mind its value. Ruth shared the statistics of 76% understand the value, but 37% have a mentor. We don't follow through. And that's because a lot of people are just lost. They don't understand how to start, what to do, what the relationship looks like, what to ask, what mentoring looks like. That's what we've tried to achieve in the book. One thing we haven't talked about that I think is really important is that it's not just down to the mentor. It's not just down to the mentee. If it's mentoring within an organization, whether that's a company, public service, government department, whether it's a charity, whether it's an association, The culture of the organization we're in can encourage people to find a mentor, support them in doing so, and support the process. But again, I've walked into so many companies over the years where mentoring has come up as a topic and people haven't had a clue that there's a mentoring program. And that's just the people running them, let alone who the mentors are, who the mentees are, and how you match them. So it's a book that looks at the importance of making an impact as a mentor, the reasons why you should carry on being a mentee and how to make the most out of that, but also how to create the framework whereby you can support an environment that encourages and rewards mentoring as a process.
Okay, thank you. Ruth?
I am an academic and I used to run and I still run mentoring programs. And if I needed guidance or if I wanted to look for some of the research behind it, or if I wanted to look for worksheets, I had to go through a dozen different books and take a piece from this one, a piece from that one, a piece from the other one. And here the data was outdated and no longer contemporary thinking about mentoring. And it's frustrating. because we know mentoring works, but we didn't have a template roadmap, if you will, a blueprint on how to do it well. So this book is everything that I had always been looking for, but had never found. And it's all in one place. How to be a mentor, how to be a mentee, how to run mentoring programs, backed by science, filled with stories, filled with templates and worksheets and checklists and scripts. And it's short enough that you can pick it up in New York. By the time you land in California, you have read almost all of it. You can go back to it at any time. This is literally the book that I've been searching for my entire career. Now here it is, Financial Times.
Just to say that I can't take statements like that on face value, so therefore I now have to go to New York and fly to California to test out the hypothesis.
You're always welcome.
We're all going to try that out. So thank you both, Ruth and Andy. We've been talking about the Financial Times Guide to Mentoring, which is available. Go find it. Go buy it. You need that, and you need to read it cover to cover, whether you're on an aeroplane or not. Take a long train journey. Take a day.
I think it's for the entire team.
Read the book. That's been brilliant. It's been great sharing this time with you. Thank you very much. I'm Alan Stevens. Join Andy LaPata next week for another episode of the Connected Leadership Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Leadership Podcast. If you found this valuable, please subscribe, tell your colleagues and friends, share on social media, and post a review on the podcast channel you use to listen to it. And of course, join us again soon for another interesting interview and great Connected Leadership Tips.